is Lake Air 1260 FM, WLAK, Murray's Radio Station. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. What happened on board the MS Dolly in the minutes leading up to it crashing into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore? NTSB investigator Marcel Muse said they begun listening to the voice recorder from the ship's bridge.
Around 1:27 and 25 seconds, the pilot issued a radio call over the VHF radio, reporting that the Dolly had lost all power and was approaching the bridge.
NTSB investigators were on board the vessel today. Former Senator and Democratic 2000 pick for Vice President Joe Lieberman died today, his family said, from complications after a fall. He was 82. A stabbing spree in Rockford, Illinois has left four people dead, others seriously injured. A 22-year-old suspect's in custody, no clear motive. Washington, D.C., keeping its basketball and hockey teams. A plan to lure the teams to Virginia imploded, and ownership and the city reached an agreement on a $515 million publicly funded arena project. This is ABC News.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. As many as 21% of Wisconsin adults could see their representation in the state legislature flip parties this fall. The Journal Sentinel bases that forecast on historical trends. The biggest changes could come to Green Bay, Eau Claire, rural south central Wisconsin, Racine and Kenosha, and the Driftless region. President Biden's campaign co-chairman was in La Crosse and Wausau today talking about boosting the economy with infrastructure projects.
Presidents for 50 years talked about doing it. Nobody could do it, but the president did at $1.2 trillion because those are the things that are creating jobs for high-paying union workers that are transforming communities.
Mitch Landrieu spearheaded the president's trillion-dollar infrastructure plan. He met with mayors in Madison, Milwaukee, Racine, and Sheboygan Tuesday. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
The Todd Alba Show.
I love me some Drew Holiday. My favorite Buck. I love what he's doing. I just really, really wish it wasn't for the Boston Celtics. My loyalty is still more to Giannis. But, like, when Drew scores a bucket still, I'm like, yeah.
That's like to a former Drew. Lover.
I got it a Drew Holiday jersey, a Bucks jersey, and I got an Aaron Jones Packers jersey. This is so why I'm a scoring former lover for both of those players.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to Lake Air WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton evidently reached a deal with federal prosecutors on his felony security fraud charges that they dropped against him, and the trial that was supposed to begin in a couple of weeks canceled. This, they're saying, major win for Ken Paxton. He's a little slap on the wrist. It's kind of what we've been talking about corporate America. A little slap on the wrist, no big deal, promise don't do it again, little fine, maybe some community service kind of stuff, a little bit that he's got to do. In fact, Ken Paxton's got to do 100 hours of community service, take 15 hours of legal ethics courses, and pay about $300,000 in restitution to the people who accused him of defrauding them. Now, you, me, the rest of us, we're going to jail. And this is one of those things where you go, do we buy into the idea that there is blind justice, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law? Or do the rich and powerful get away with, well, whatever they want? Now, another story, Matt Schlapp. You remember Matt Schlapp? He's the guy who is the head of the American Conservative Union, the folks who bring a CPAC, the crazy PAC. You remember during the campaign where Herschel Walker was running for Senate, one of his staffers claimed that Schlapp had grabbed him by the you-know-what and was outed and eventually, filed a lawsuit, and there was all kinds of stuff. Evidently, it was a misunderstanding. Misunderstanding. I've never had anyone grab me by the, you know, and go, oh, I didn't realize. evidently, this guy, Carlton Huffman, Walker's campaign person, issued a statement saying, quote, the claims made in my lawsuit were the result of a complete misunderstanding, and I regret that the lawsuit caused pain to the Schlapp family. The Schlapps have advised that the statements made about me were the result of a misunderstanding, which was regrettable. Neither the Schlapps nor ACU paid me anything to dismiss my claims against them, which means that somebody paid them. It may not have been them. And this is, again, one of these things where whether this is the reality or not, the appearance of there being unequal justice is right there front and center. And this idea that, again, like I said, the law applies to everyone equally. We have the rule of law, blind justice. Remember when Trump said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue? And people go, oh, he's just joking. No, he wasn't joking. And I said he wasn't joking when he said it. He believes that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And look, have we not changed the rules, bent over backwards to accommodate Donald Trump? Has he not gotten everything you could possibly wrangle out of the legal system and get away with that you or me or any working person would have never been allowed to get away with? What did they reduce his fine to get the appeal from? Was it $456 million down to what, $175? Oh, you or I couldn't get that reduced from $450 down to $175 if our life depended on it. In fact, if it were us, it would go the other way. And this is one of those moments where you go, the wealthy, the rich and powerful, big corporate America, they have more freedom. They have more liberty because they can buy it. They can afford more freedom. They can afford more rights, more liberty. They can afford it. They can afford the armies of legal experts. They can afford the best representation their money can buy. Whereas the average working person, what freedom do you really have? I know we like to think that, you know, we're just a free country. No, this is an expensive country. You've got to pay to have somewhere to live. You got to pay to put food on the table. You got to pay in a lot of places to get an education. You got to pay for health care, everything down the line. And the less money you have, the less of all those things that you get. And I would argue that's your freedom. And it's been taken away over the last 40, 50 years. You know, my grandparents' generation fought for economic security, understanding that's freedom. Having the ability to defend yourself, having the ability to take a day off from work, having the ability to make better, different choices because you have wealth, that is freedom. And you go, well, how do we get that back? How do we put the genie back in the bottle? Maybe, you know, take down a notch our billionaire class and ensure that working people have a little bit of that wealth. And I've argued for years, we got to increase the minimum wage. You know, the fight for 15 was a good beginning. I had someone the other day tell me, no, Rick, it shouldn't be 15. It should be 40. And I'm going, okay, you know, why not? We've got billionaires who are lining their pockets. Yesterday, we talked about the billionaire class seeing their wealth jump during the pandemic, 88%. You know, the minimum wage hasn't been raised in what, 14 years, 15 years? There's a problem here. We need to be fighting for stronger workers' rights, better collective bargaining rights, the right to organize, all of those things so that you have more bargaining power to demand some of the wealth that your labor creates that is profiting the billionaires. You know, you look at Jeff Bezos, his money's in Amazon. Those workers should be earning a higher living because they're creating a massive amount of profit and wealth. But workers don't have that collective power to say, you know what? Our guys, our owner's worth a gazillion dollars. Maybe I shouldn't have to beg the government for a free school lunch program for my kids. Maybe I shouldn't have to ask for food stamps to put food on the table. Maybe. And look, we should be investing in education. We should be investing in job training. We should be investing in all of those things instead of going, you know, kids need to skin in the game. You know, they should take on massive life-altering student debt just for the chance to get into the middle class. What sense does any of this make? Because again, we've turned education into a profit center. Education Incorporated has gotten us to going, hey, well, you know what? You want to live the good life? Oh, you're going to have to pay. There are so many things we should be doing to address income inequality. And it starts for me with joining and forming unions. But again, what we have is a government, the best democracy money can buy, owned by a handful of wealthy donors who get to decide who runs for office, who can get their message out, and most of the time, what that message is. So when you hear someone like Trump, who finally, you know, like a blind squirrel finding a nut, going, talking about issues that workers care about, like bad trade policies, you know, manufacturing in your neighborhood, you know, those kind of things, you pay attention and you go, hey, this could be our guy. Problem is you look at what he did. And again, I go back to what he did. What he did was make sure that, well, the wealthy were well taken care of. And the working class screwed again. So I come back to, again, the question. When are we going to wake up and say no more? When are we going to start voting in a way that says, hey, we want better policy outcomes. We want better opportunities for our kids and our grandkids. We want better. We come back, I'm going to talk with Oscar Ocampo from the Institute of Policy Studies about his piece on our billionaire class and their little windfall during the pandemic. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, I got a really good kick out of the CEO of Bentley, a guy named Adrian Hallmark, who said that the reason that Bentley was having a downturn in sales, not because the prices are really, really high, but because rich people are, quote, experiencing emotional sensitivity. Because, well, working people are struggling. The cost of living's high. They don't want to flaunt their wealth. That's the argument. Evidently, he's leaving Bentley, going to go to Aston Martin, where I guess prices are much, much lower. But this brings up an interesting thing. Is it true? Do you think the wealthy who have, well, pocketed so much over the last several years, 40, do you think they really care what the average commoner thinks? Do you think they care what you or me think about how much wealth they have? I know politically in this country they're not worried. But here to share some thoughts on just how bad it's gotten, I've asked Omar Ocampo to come talk with us. Omar is a researcher with the Institute for Policy Studies, ips-dc.org, the website, if you want to take a look at their work. Omar, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of this? You got the CEO of this Bentley car company going, well, the reason sales are down are, you know, rich people just feel bad. They feel bad because they're so rich that they don't want to flaunt their wealth by driving a Bentley around. Are we buying that?
Yeah, we're not buying that at all. And if anything, if we looked at the, you know, what I like to call the 50-year counter-revolution, is that, you know, the tax rates at the top for the wealthy have gone down, and they have accumulated more wealth than, you know, any of us can even think of. So, yeah, we shouldn't be feeling sorry for them. And they're doing pretty well, even if they don't flaunt it or they're hesitant to flaunt it. I mean, they're buying up land. They're buying up everything. They're buying our media, the, you know, major newspapers, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the reason that the cost of living keeps going up, especially in the rental housing market, is because, well, our hedge fund family, they're buying up all of the properties. But I talked about your research yesterday on the program, and the fact that, as you've pointed out, our billionaire class here in the U.S. saw their wealth jump 88% since the beginning of the pandemic. And I asked the question to the audience, how many people saw their wealth go up 88%? And the majority of people who responded said, no, wait, my wealth actually went backwards. More people are actually struggling more now than they were before. So you've got the wealth class here. They seem to be eating all the pie.
Yes. So the pie is growing and they're not sharing a bigger slice at all. Before I even start, I think it's very interesting the point that you talk about how, you know, the, you know, corporations and rich people and the ultra wealthy, they're buying a lot of our housing stock. So they're actually reducing the supply of housing, which increases the prices of homes and rent for all of us. So that becomes a greater expense for us. Now, with regards to, like, for example, you know, the billionaire class, you know, they've done really well in the past 4 years. So I remember when the Forbes came out with their 2020 billionaire list, that they were just like, oh, look at these, poor billionaires, their wealth has gone down significantly, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, we wanted at IPS to keep a track on this, and very quickly it rebounded. And why did it rebound? It's because they had a big public investment. The government came there and injected a lot of money and propped up their businesses and propped up the stock market, and then it gave them confidence, and they were able to gamble with their money, and it does not trickle down. The working class is still struggling to make ends meet, and it just goes to show that, you know, even though the working class helped produce the billions of dollars, produce the wealth, it's not trickling into their bank accounts. It's flowing into the bank accounts of the billionaire class, who have seen a $2.5 trillion gain in 4 years, which is unfathomable.
No, it's just mind blowing. But, you know, I remember the Reagan era. I guess I'm old enough to remember the whole sales pitch of moving away from the 70% tax rate that it was when Reagan took office for our ultra wealthy, and dropping that all the way down to 28%. And I remember George H.W. Bush losing re-election because he promised that he wouldn't raise taxes. But when he saw the red ink in the books, he said, we got to do something. And he lost re-election because they did move to raise taxes. We were told in that whole sales pitch that if we give the rich people enough, if we give them everything because they're smart, they're more efficient, they know what to do with it, it would flow down to us like rivers of gold and honey. It was going to be amazing. It was going to be the greatest thing ever. And yet I look at from then till now, and the working class of this country has gotten the screw job every single year, while our billionaires, well, we've created what now? The 750 of them, 1,000 of them? I don't even know. But it didn't flow downward.
It did not flow downward. You know, it's also interesting because, you know, Trump also delivered a tax cut in 2017, and it was actually one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation in the past 25 years. And he promised that it would give a boost to everybody. It was like, hey, you know, all workers, everybody, they will get a boost in their income or wages. And then there was actually an independent study earlier this year that looked at, hey, what was the impact of this Trump tax cut? Because and it showed that the primary beneficiaries of the tax cut were the top 1%. They saw an average of $60,000 extra from this tax cut. You want to take a guess at how much the working class or the vast majority of workers, which I think is said like 90%.
Like 200 bucks? Zero.
There was very little increase in earnings or wages. So it just goes to show that our democratic institutions are captured by the billionaire class, by the top 1%, by the ultra wealthy who, they accumulate all this wealth and then they influence public policy, and it doesn't make it responsive to the electors, and that's who they should be accountable to. They should be accountable to the people who elect them, not necessarily those who gave a $10 million donation through some, super PAC or some other channel. So there's continuity from Reagan to Bush to Trump. They're all about decreasing taxes, and which doesn't flow downward. That theory has been debunked, scientifically. And I mean, one of the good things that Joe Biden is doing is that he wants a billionaire income tax, that where they're not just taxing their salaries, what they work, but also
a wealth tax.
Different income streams. I mean, it's not necessarily a wealth tax. I mean, I would be in favor of a wealth tax. We'd take a look at the net worth and then tax it accordingly to 5%. But he's looking at you're receiving income from capital gains. We should be taxing that. That should be taxed at a higher rate as well. So it could raise significant amount of funds that can be invested, for the public good.
And this is a question that I asked yesterday on the program, and I've asked, all 19 years of doing this show, why is it that we tax capital gains at a lower rate than we tax people who are going to work for a living? Why is it that we tax, passive income at a much lower rate? Why is it that we allow what benefits the ultra wealthy to be taxed differently and at lower rates than, people going out there and busting their behind? And when will we wake up to that reality and say, there are more of us, we've out-procreated them, maybe we can get them to start paying, I don't know. I'm not saying dig up Dwight Eisenhower and bring back his tax code, but something close to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just highlights the need for, labor, for the, working class to organize and form unions and demand and get a bigger share of the pie. I think, one of the reasons why, the passive income is taxed at a lower rate is, to me, it just shows that, our government, there's been an ideological shift in the past 50 years that pretty much privileges the investor class or the business owners or entrepreneurs, because they say they know how to do things more efficiently with their money, that we shouldn't tax it.
No, I agree with them, Omar. Here's the thing. I believe that they are smart. I believe they know what to do with money. And it's not good for you or me. It's not good for society. It's good for them. They know what's in their radical self-interest, and that's more accumulation of wealth for them. And it was never going to trickle down. I'm sorry. Their pockets never fill. Nothing ever spills out. Their insatiable appetite for more never, never ends. So this idea that benevolency and, maybe someday something will spill out is never going to happen. For me, this is where you need sound policy to start going, you know what? You made a lot of money. A lot's expected of you. You're going to kick in. And I don't know why voters don't think like that.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows that we need to make this a central point in any type of any campaign. I do agree with you. When they have extra money in their bank account, we've been told that they would invest it in like productivity. They'll create more jobs. They'd create more businesses. They'll have some innovation, etc. But that's not the case. What they end up doing with their money is they end up gambling with it. They do speculation. They invested in luxury real estate, basically, and then hide it behind like some LLC so it won't get taxed, right? So they do everything to avoid taxation. But I think that there's more productive ways of using this revenue. Again, they didn't create it on their own. They have managers, they have employees that help produce that. And I think that either you know, we argue for, you know, a better pay for, you know, the workers, which is why they should unionize or, you know, organize amongst themselves. And then we should just tax them at a higher, you know, a tax rate. You know, there's a lot of projects that we need to invest in. You know, there's green transportation, you know, more, you know, better infrastructure, you know, get universal health care, you know, free public university education, et cetera. So, I mean, the resources are there. We just got to, you know, have the political will and to target it. And, you know, I think with the, you know, with the right, you know, proposals and ideas and the good messaging, then, you know, the vast majority of people will wake up to that fact, because like you said earlier, there's more of us than them. So we should be, you know, arguing for our interests and not their interests.
No, that's an excellent point. And look, you know, I go back to the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. We had a 92% top marginal tax rate. Now, nobody paid that because they invested in other things. They built new factories. They invested in libraries and schools and hospitals. They paid their workers more. There was that actual trickle down because none of those rich people wanted to give government the money. But they used it for the benefit of the community in a much different way than now, where they're just hoarding it, or, you know, hey, just shove it in an offshore account somewhere where they can hide it from everybody. And I know we're a much more global society than we were back then, but I think you can enact some of these pieces of legislation. You just have to have the will and the backing of the American people. And that comes back to, I think, educating workers on how bad we've been screwed over the last 40, 50 years.
Absolutely. And that's a very good point, because when they paid a higher tax rate, they were just like, I'd rather just give it, you know, to my employees as opposed to the government. Like, that's a very good point. And also, there was a lot of innovation happening in the 1950s and 60s. You know, a lot of the stuff that, you know, a lot of technology, you know, it's got tinkered and then it's got perfected today, but a lot of it has a genesis back in the 50s, 60s, you know, something like Bell Labs, right? So, but yeah, you know, where I'm all for the higher tax rate, not just on income, but also on wealth, because even there are going to be some ultra wealthy people who will say, yeah, you know what, you should tax me more, but don't tax my wealth, because that's where the real power lays. Yep. Because they have that concentration of, I would say extreme concentration of wealth.
Which is why the inheritance tax was so important, that they've successfully basically neutered. I want to get last. I know you've done a lot of research on this, and I got to get your thought on who's your favorite billionaire. I've got mine. Mine is Stephen Schatz Biscotti, partial owner of the Baltimore Ravens, and made his money the old-fashioned way by sending American jobs overseas. He's an outsourcer. So if we got to have a favorite billionaire, why not? Because, hey, we paid for him. It's our standard of living that's gone down to ensure that they've got all these billions. So do you have a favorite?
That's a question I've never thought of before. I mean, I would say normally I would say none are my favorite, but if I could give credit to one billionaire, it'll probably be Mackenzie Scott. So because she's actually, you know, all billionaires will say, hey, you know, a good portion of the billionaires will say, hey, you know what, we're going to, you know, have some type of pledge where we're going to give away most of our wealth by the time, you know, within the next 20, 30 years. But you know what they do? They don't actually give away all their wealth, right? And even the stuff they do donate, it sits like in some type of fund, and they get the immediate tax credit, but yet the money that they donated doesn't get dispersed until, you know, because it could sit in that fund indefinitely. But Mackenzie Scott, you know, she's actually giving away a lot of money to a lot of foundations and universities, no strings attached, which is the thing that's very impressive. No strings attached, and she's giving it away. Now, I think, you know, one of the problems with this is that, you know, her wealth is expanding faster than she can give it away, which shows that there's a structural problem in our system that wealth continues to accumulate even when they're not really, you know, contributing, you know, like you said, not even working, a 9-to-5, but. Yeah, she. I would say that Mackenzie Scott, if I had to choose one, she would probably be.
No, you chose the right road. That's the good road. I chose sarcasm, and you know, and, you know, trying to make a shot at someone, you chose the right road. Because as you pointed out in your research piece, she's the only billionaire on the list to have actually lost money during this pandemic period because she was giving it away. So, you know, I'm with you. She's a okay one. I'm going to go okay. I'm not going to go good. But Omar, I appreciate the work you guys do there. Great stuff. I hope I'll talk to you again real soon.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me on, and I look forward to coming back on in the future, and, you know, we can solve the world's problems.
There you go. Omar Ocampo, researcher over there at the Institute for Policy Studies. Want to hear your thoughts. Do you have a favorite billionaire? I mean, after all, you paid for him. It's your standard of living that's gone down. It's your wages that have been stagnant. It's your health care that you're paying more for and getting less for. It's your pension that's gone. But we've got billionaires, the most in the world. Here's something we're number one at. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A few flurries ending, then we'll see some clearing overnight. Lows in the upper single digits and west winds. On Thursday, sunny skies, lower 30s. On Friday, we'll be in the lower 40s with partly sunny skies. Just a slight chance of rain Friday afternoon. It's 21 at our studios.
Are record energy costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive in the blistering heat of summer or the bitter cold of winter. While you haven't asked for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever...
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Tuesday, a horrible tragedy. Part of the Baltimore Beltway. They see about 30,000 vehicles every day going over the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And look, I'm looking at this, the video of this bridge collapsing. Because a barge evidently lost power and ran into one of the supports. And it just collapsed. And it's one of those things where, as someone who's you know, driven a truck for a living all these years, you know, you go over some of these bridges and there's no escape. There's nowhere to go. And this was one of those. I've been over that bridge, I can't tell you how many times. There are no shoulders. There's nowhere to go. There's road. There's the edge. And I saw this collapse, and, you know, my heart goes out to the workers who were left on there. And there's going to be an investigation on why they weren't removed. They were able to shut down the road so no traffic could come through. How it is, the eight workers that were left on that bridge filling potholes. Now the communication, don't know. I'm sure we will get to the bottom of it. As of my understanding, six of the workers are still missing. And cold water, I wouldn't hold much hope in this moment for those six workers. Two were rescued, one unharmed, one is in serious condition. But, you know, I'm looking at this, and I think the Biden administration did what any administration should do. They got the resources there. Government was in action. The Coast Guard was on the site. You saw government in action. You saw the wheels working. Did everything you could possibly do, with the exception of communicating with those eight construction workers on that bridge. Now, is that a Coast Guard issue? Is that the company working on that bridge? Is it the fact that, you know, I don't know. You know, I do know that if you're working on a bridge, you're supposed to have, some flotation device. If it's your vest or if it's a life jacket or something, I know you're supposed to. Don't know if these workers had this stuff. But look, you know, when a bridge collapses from that height, you know, debris falling, it's horrible and it's tragic. And I give the president credit. They're going to rebuild it. I wonder what Congress will do and what if this will become a political football, which, you know, unfortunately, given where we are, I wouldn't be surprised. The last time we had a major bridge collapse, I think takes us back to, what, 2007, August, when the I-35W bridge collapsed there in Minnesota, killing, I think, 13 and injuring and another 145. They were able to rebuild that. It opened in September of 2008. So, you know, a little over a year, they were able to get that bridge back up, rebuilt, and operational. This is another major thoroughfare. I'm hopeful that they're able to get this rebuilt. But, you know, as I was watching these videos and as I was, you know, reading some of the stories, and look, the kooks are out too. Almost immediately, you saw, this was a planned demolition. This was a control. See, here's where they blew things up. So of course you've got the kooks out there who are claiming that it was Joe Biden doing a little wet work, because you know we wanted to get those six construction workers. But as I watched some of the videos, immediately I picked up on the lights went out on the ship. They came back. And this was at first I thought just a freak accident, you know, going, you know, I don't know how this happens. Did the captain fall asleep? Was the captain drunk? Was there mutiny? Who knows? Who knows what happens in these moments when a tragedy like this happens? Because look, you know, we're not used to seeing this. This isn't a normal Tuesday. And, you know, as more unfolded, we find out the boat is, you know, chartered out of Singapore. It's one of these things that we find out there's some questionable behavior about treatment of whistleblowers who are, you know, talking about safety concerns. My mind immediately goes to that place because, you know, we've been talking about East Palestine for a very long time and how the company, you know, rushes inspections, how, you know, they pencil whip preventative maintenance, how they hurry up the workers to where they really don't have the time to do a thorough inspection. We don't really know if everything's safe. We're just relying on faith. So my mind goes to that place. You know, this company, you know, based out of Singapore, coming into the U.S., how much regulation do we have? How much control do we have over what's being sailed into our ports and under our bridges? And will we find that, yeah, here was another company, you know, squeezing the quarter till the eagle screamed, trying to get the most productivity and the most out of what the equipment that they have. Because I haven't been able to find out yet how old this barge was, how old this equipment was, when the last time it had preventative maintenance, you know, what the maintenance schedule was. There's a lot of stuff here for the NTSB, the FBI, for, you know, the alphabet soup to be looking into. And again, it got me just, you know, going back into this world of, you know, it's always profit over people. Now, look, this could have been. And I'm gonna just throw this out there as it's possible that this was just a freak accident. Things happen. This could be just, hey, you know, we did everything we could humanly possibly do to avoid a crisis, to avoid a catastrophe, to avoid this tragedy. We did it all. And, you know, act of God, it just happened. That could possibly be what the outcome is. But again, I keep coming back to this place where we've seen, you know, in the era of mass deregulation, we've seen these stories over and over again where, you know, somebody wants to, you know, go talk to the Coast Guard about, hey, they're doing something wrong, and they get disciplined, they get fired. There's a culture of harassment if you have the audacity to point out flaws. Now, we probably won't get the official response to this for a year or two down the road, because this is what corporate America plans on, that we're going to forget that, you know, we have short memories. There are other things that are going to pop up. There are other things that are going to grab our attention, and we're going to forget about this. And they will come out with a report on, you know, why there was a failure to communicate to those construction workers, and what happened on that ship. What caused it to run into one of the main supports, causing the whole thing to come down like a bridge of toothpicks. It was, as someone, again, who has driven over my share of bridges, one of my greatest fears being on that ship, being on that bridge and something happening and down you go. You know, as someone who's gone over the George Washington Bridge a number of times, you know, that's way up there. But I'm interested, again, to see where all of those questions that I have, and I'm sure our government agencies will have as well. And why we as voters don't take this stuff more serious. Now, look, you know, again, the message out of this is going to be it was a freak accident. Things happen. Things happen, Rick, you know, bad things happen. And that's true. Bad things do happen. I absolutely agree. But more often than not, oddly enough, more often than not, what you have are places where people cut corners. Places where there were predictable consequences to not doing inspections, not doing preventative maintenance, running a ship longer than its lifespan, not upgrading to newer technology that could have helped, you know, maybe solve some of the problems. Because again, it's about the profit over the people, and not just the people on the bridge, but you know, bad things could have happened to people on the ship as well. That's where my mind is. And you know, I don't want to use this tragedy as a sound off, but it kind of has to be. It kind of has to be us going, you know, this stuff happens more than it should. And maybe we do need better regulators. Maybe we do need more funding to go into those regulators and those bodies to ensure that things are safe. That those workers would have been communicated with. I guarantee you this, every worker who is on a bridge on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, they're going to be thinking about, hey, what happens if something goes wrong? Where's my exit? And that is a good place for workers to think. You know, one of the main rules that, you know, early on when you listen to the old timers, who tell you about, you know, I'm a truck driver. You're just a guy who holds a steering wheel, but we'll make a truck driver out of you yet. One of the things that they always say is you always got to leave yourself an out. There's always got to be a way to escape. There's always got to be somewhere for you to go. And that's not just in driving, you know, a truck or anything. That's in life. Always, there's always got to be an off ramp. There's always got to be a safe exit. There's always got to be a way to ensure that you're safe in the event of catastrophe. Our hearts and our thoughts go out to the families who lost loved ones in this tragedy. But I can't, I know, maybe it's just how my mind works, but I can't fathom how without their, with, I just can't. And we'll see. Like I said, though, I'm sure there will be plenty of reports. There'll be plenty of comments. Plenty of opportunities for the social medias to lose their minds and ensure that you know this becomes the next scandal, the next it was done on purpose. This will be maybe the next 9/11. I don't know. It's really, and I'm not making comparisons between this and 9/11. It's the conspiracy theories that came out of it. But I'm looking at I'm looking at some of the videos of people explaining, you know, demolitions work and how this was a planned demolition. Yeah, it's that. Want to hear your thoughts? Have you been over the Francis Scott Key Bridge there in Baltimore? I got to tell you, it always freaked me out. And to see it go down the way it did and collapse the way it did as that cargo ship's just going through it, man, I've had not nightmares, but I've had moments. And I'm sure you have as well. But, you know, as I said, good on the Biden administration for saying that we're going to get the resources in place to rebuild this. He has to. Now the question is, what will Congress do? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2002. That was the day that the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision in the case Hoffman Plastic Compound Incorporated versus the National Labor Relations Board. This case had profound importance for undocumented workers in the United States. The conflict began 14 years before, as the United Cork, Linoleum, and Plastic Workers of America began an organizing drive at Hoffman. The California company made plastic pipeworks. Hoffman retaliated by firing all the employees that supported the union. One of those fired was Jose Castro, an undocumented worker. The fired workers took their case to the National Labor Relations Board, where they won. The board ruled that the company had to provide back pay for the workers it had unfairly fired. This ruling included Castro. The company decided to fight the decision, and the case wound its way through the courts for a decade. Finally, it arrived on the Supreme Court docket. The highest court in the land ruled in favor of the company in a 5-4 decision. It ruled that as an undocumented worker, Castro could not claim back pay. Writing for the dissent, Justice Stephen Breyer warned that the decision, quote, might very well increase the strength of this magnetic force of undocumented migration. If employers do not worry about the penalties for breaking the law that protect workers, they might be more likely to hire undocumented labor. 10 years after the case, an article in the Princeton Law Review called the decision, quote, a powerful legal symbol of exclusion of immigrant workers. Trying to divide the workforce has long been a tactic of owners determined to break the power of labor. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So evidently, Rona McDaniel, her tenure at NBC News didn't last very long. In fact, I guess we're going to be, you know, instead of Scaramucci's being a unit of time, it's going to be the Ronas, because Rona McDaniels, I don't even know if she really, did she actually punch in to the job? I'm not sure, but evidently, according to the NBC Universal chairman, Cesar Conde, his memo on Tuesday apologizing to the NBC News staff for hiring Rona, saying it has become clear that this appointment undermines the goal of a cohesive and aligned newsroom. Really? And, you know, for me as a worker guy, as someone who says, you know, when workers realize they have power, they can make changes. They can make changes in their workplace. They can get better wages, hours, conditions. This was a moment where the news people, the worker bees, if you will, rich worker bees, well paid, where the worker bees are like, hey, wait a minute. No. And you got, you know, the commentators who kind of took a beating because, well, you know, they broke the first rule of journalism. You know, they made the story about them. Yeah, because they were angry. And they were angry that this is a person, Rona McDaniels, who undermined everything that they were doing for years. And then to have to treat that person as a colleague, a respected colleague? No. And look, you knew this was going to be the outcome eventually. I just didn't think it was going to happen this quickly. And look, you know, Rona McDaniels can do the scrubbing of her social media all she wants. She still got the Trump stink all over. And this is a cautionary tale. for all of those people who have bought into, oh, your 2020 was stolen, and oh, poor Donald. No. This is what should happen to you. Because the weird thing is she knew better. And this is what I've been saying for a very long time. Is it worse in Rona McDaniel's case? Is it worse if she was a true believer? If she came out and said, no, look, I believed it. I was on board. I was there. I'm a true believer. Or is it worse that, look, what she did? Look, you know, I was afraid of Trump. You know, he's the power. You know, I gotta acquiesce to the power. You know, I gotta clearly, you know, get in line. Which is worse? The people who are brain dead or the people who have no spine? And I guess this could be a Wizard of Oz kind of scenario. No courage, no brain, no soul, no heart, none of that. But she's out. So a tenure too long, I would argue. But Rona McDaniels will not be at NBC Universal. Maybe Fox will come a calling or one of the other right-wing outlets to save the day. I don't think so, though, because I think not only did she burn her bridge with reality and sanity, she's now burned her bridge with Trump World, which I don't think she was doing all that well before. Speaking of Trump World, oh my goodness, Easter coming, Good Friday, just around the corner. Our former commander in chief, our con man in chief, he's got a new gig. He's got a new gig. He's going to be a door-to-door Bible salesman or a social media Bible salesman. He truthed out a happy Holy Week. Let's make America pray again. As we lead into Good Friday and Easter, I encourage you to get a copy of the God Bless the USA Bible. You can get that at GodBlessTheUSABible.com. And you got to wonder, where are the proceeds going? Are they going to pay his legal bills? Because here's the thing. He's not even making the old argument that, you know, the televangelists make. You know, you give me $5 and it'll be $5 in the bank of heaven. You're storing up good graces when you get to your final destination. He's not even making that. But, you know, I guess the question is, surprised? Anybody shocked? Anybody? No, of course not. Because, of course, this is who Trump is. He is a... You know, I hate to disparage used car salesmen. I do. I mean, you know, to compare him to a used car salesman, at least you get something from a used car salesman. It might be a lemon, might be, you know, the odometer may have been rolled back. But, you know, with Trump, all you get are empty promises and a whole lot of bizarre rhetoric. And, of course, you know, no one plays the victim like Donald Trump does. Easter's around the corner. Get your God Save the USA Bible. Of which I got to wonder if you know, one, if he held upright, because I can't see in the picture if he held it upright, or if he's ever read it. That's the other part. So there you go. Quick, I want to get to a couple of emails quick before we wrap up today. John sent me an email saying, thank you for taking Boeing to task and corporate America in general. It's about time someone speaks out against the abuses and criminality of corporate America. And it's about time an administration actually does something to hold them accountable. And look, you know, I think the Biden administration is doing a little more, could do a whole lot more. We talked about this yesterday on the program. But I came across some interesting numbers. And, you know, my basic view, and I think a lot of people share this with me, is kind of where we started today, where the rich and powerful, they get away with whatever they want because they've got the legal teams to manipulate the system, to drag things out, to use the best legal minds to game the system to their benefit and basically overpower overworked, underpaid, city prosecutors, district attorneys, whatever. And by saying, look, you know, we'll agree to something. You can look like you won politically, but it's not going to really hurt us. That's kind of what happens. And I look at the thing with Ken Paxton, where we started this off. seems like that's kind of the situation. But in looking at these corporations that the DOJ does go after, not surprising that, you know, when corporations have 50 or few employees, they're prosecuted about 70, I think the number was 76% of the corporations that the DOJ prosecutes has less than 50 employees. They're going after the low-hanging fruit, while only 12% had more than 1,000 employees. You go, well, but Rick, the big companies, you know, they've got HR departments, they've got all kinds of people to ensure that they're regulating themselves. And if you were to say that, I would say, no, you're no. Did I mention no? That's not quite how that works. I would say they've got an army of attorneys that gets them a little more justice than the rest of us, that gives them more opportunity to not go to jail than the rest of us. And for me, that moment where you go, look, the rich and powerful, they have a separate justice system. They have a different level of accountability and responsibility. And in the old days, you could argue, and I've had some people argue, and I've disagreed, that in the old days, we held our elites to a higher standard. We expected more from them because they were the upper crust of society. And I would argue that's bunk. They just had better PR people to spew that nonsense. But it's the mindset that we're sold as kids. You know, every six-year-old in school is, the great thing about the country is justice is blind. See the woman with the scales? She's got a blindfold. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. The system's going to treat you the same. Nonsense. And we all know that. We all know that there's two separate justice systems. The one for the working people and the one for the rich and powerful. And the rich and powerful continue to get away with all kinds of malfeasance. Usually in the dark, we always see, oh, there was an agreement made. The company promised they won't do it again. Details are sealed. So we don't actually even get to know what the crime was. We don't really get to know, you know, who the crime was against. But we know that, you know, something happened and they posted a notice. They said they won't do it again. They promise. Until, of course, as we all know, they do it the next time. So am I shocked that these numbers are the way they are? No, and none of us should be. And this is why I go back to, you know, as working people, we need to find our working class roots. We need to find the solidarity with our neighbors. And not, you know, and this is where the whole Trump cult thing to me is just bizarre. That there are people who go to work, punch a clock, work their butts off, and they're siding with a guy who's never done an actual honest day's work in his life, who has no idea what your existence is like, has no idea how hard it is for you to put food on the table or keep a roof over your head. This is a guy who, you know, born with the golden spoon, the proverbial golden spoon in his mouth. And yet somehow we've been sold on this. So for me, the hope again is that we wake up with the idea of solidarity with each other and say, hey, how do we make each of our lives better? How do we make our community better? You know, for me, that's the great hope and hopefully the way forward. But that's just me. That's my mindset. I'm very distrustful of the rich and powerful and big corporations. And yes, I know I'm distrustful of government as well, just not to the extent of corporate America and their greed monster overlords. Just my thought. But I do want to hear yours. Am I right? Am I wrong? Does it get you mad? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast wherever you get yours. You'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.